Hello, everybody. welcome to Lecture 4. I want to apologize for giving the lecture not at the originally scheduled time. I had to see the eye doctor on Tuesday at the time scheduled for the lecture, so I couldn't make it. I'm doing much better now, and besides, eyes are greatly overrated anyway. Now, before I get into the topic of today's lecture, I want to say a few words. I was looking over some of the quizzes, and as I told you, I try to make these easy, but I saw there were some questions people had missed, and I just want to go over a few of those because I think some of the points were important. Now, one question I asked was, what was the attitude of Mises and Rothbard to natural law? And the answer that I wanted was that Rothbard accepted natural law and Mises rejected it. Mises did not believe in natural law. But there were a number of people who thought answered that both Mises and Rothbard accepted natural law. So one thing I was trying to think, well, why would people think that? And one point you have to avoid when you're answering questions is this. You might reason somewhat like this, well, Mises and Rothbard are both good guys and natural law is good, so they must both have accepted it. But as it happens, Mises didn't, so you have to be extremely careful there. Now, another one, it was a bit confusing, involved the famous action axiom that man acts or human beings act. And I asked, who is that axiom associated with? And there were a number of people who thought it was Mises. Now, I can't blame people for answering that way because I used to think that too, and I think Murray Rothbard sometimes suggested that Mises said that, but he didn't. If you look at the text of Human Action, Mises says that praxeology, the theorems of praxeology follow from the concept of action, which is concept. Remember, concept is an idea, would be a word, like say action is a concept, but a proposition or an action, the man acts, that's an assertion about a concept. So there's a difference between the concept and this axiom, and it's Rothbard who uses the action axiom, not Mises. And this leads up to the next one I wanted to mention. I tried to go over this in lecture, but it's a kind of difficult topic, and I probably didn't do a good enough job in explaining it. We have a notion of an a priori concept. Remember, this is a bit difficult. It's a concept or an idea you have to have in order to make sense of experience, or at least a certain realm of experience. So, of course, if you have to have the concept in order to make sense of experience, say we have to have a concept of action in order to understand what human beings are doing when they're acting, we don't get that concept from experience because you have to have a concept in order to understand that part of experience, so it can't come from experience. At least that's the argument of people who believe in a priori concepts. Now, a point to remember is, that I tried to go over the lecture, but people missed this, is that Mises thought there were a priori concepts, but Rothbard did not. Rothbard thought we get all our concepts from the empirical world, the world that's accessible to our senses. So we thought we get concepts by abstraction from the empirical world. So if you think that, then there aren't any a priori concepts. So it's Mises says there are a priori concepts, and Rothbard said, no, there aren't. Now, one thing you might say, but look, doesn't Rothbard say economics is an a priori science? So how can he say economics is an a priori science if he doesn't accept a priori concepts? Now here, that's an excellent question, but here, now this is the tricky point, I think this is one I should have spent more time going over, is that an a priori proposition is different from a priori concepts. Remember, a priori concepts are one you have to have in order to make sense of an experience, or part of experience, but an a priori proposition is one that you can know to be true without testing it in experience. So suppose I say no surface can be red and green all over at the same time. That's sometimes been proposed as something you could know just by thinking about it. We wouldn't have to test it and see if something could be both red and green at the same time. So that would be an example, a priori propositions, one you don't need to test by experience. But suppose you thought that is an a priori proposition. You say, oh yeah, of course, nothing can be both red and green at the same time. You don't have to think that either red or green is an a priori concept. You could think we get our color concepts by abstracting them from experience, or that they're not a priori concepts, but you can still have the a priori proposition. So an a priori proposition does not, repeat, not have to be about a priori concept. So that's how Rothbard could accept a priori propositions in economics, even though he rejected a priori concepts. Now, one more point, which was one people missed, and then we can leave. I'm sure you'll be happy we can leave all this philosophical stuff for the rest of the lecture, is when we're talking about a priori, remember, it's one you don't need to test propositions, one you don't need to test in further experience. You just think about the proposition and you, if it's an a priori true proposition, you realize it's true. Now, some people think, well, if you can do that, then isn't the proposition about something in your mind? Because if it's something, it's a proposition about the world outside your mind, then wouldn't have to be tested by experience. But that wouldn't follow. Again, suppose I say red, nothing can be both red and green at the same time. I'm not talking about ideas in my mind. I'm just talking about actual colors. And they don't, it's not something about activities in my mind that I'm talking about, but seems maybe the proposition is a priori true. So remember, an a priori true proposition is just one you don't have to test by experience, but it need not be a proposition about what's going on in someone's mind. Okay, so we can go now to the main point of the lecture. Now, I have a bit of difficulty in this lecture, which is this, that what I'm trying to do in this lecture, you know, remember in the course I'm giving you an overview of Murray Rothbard's ideas and also some account of some his life and his political activities. So I'm giving this just one lecture on his main book on called Austrian Perspective on the History of Economic Thought, which is one of his greatest scholarly achievements. So the problem I'm having is I gave two courses, each of 12 lectures dealing with this book on six, one course on the first volume, one on the second lecture, second volume. So I have a task of trying to compress 12 lectures into one single lecture. I was mentioning I had lunch with Gary Chartier today, who's some of you know, he's a libertarian philosopher. And I told him about this, so I said, well, you could summarize the book just by saying the Spanish classics were good and Adam Smith was bad, so you have an easy summary of the book right there, but I don't think we can leave it just at that. Okay, so what Rothbard is doing in this Austrian perspective on history of economic thought, he wants to reject what he sees as the older standard view of economic history. According to this standard view, at least what he considered a standard view, and one he wanted to attack, was that economics begins with Adam Smith, his famous book, The Wealth of Nations. And in this view, remember, this is the view he's attacking, it's not his own view, and you will have gathered, if you didn't know already, it isn't his view, because when I gave you that joke from Gary Chartier, said Adam Smith is bad, so if he thinks Adam Smith is bad, it's unlikely he's going to say Adam Smith was the founder of economics. According to this view, before Adam Smith, economics didn't really exist as a science. There were various people who wrote on economic topics, but they hadn't really gotten into a science yet. So what Smith did was he refuted the fallacies of the mercantilists. The mercantilists were writers, say, in the 17th century and a little earlier, who said what the state should do is to try to accumulate as much gold and silver as possible. And in order to do that, it should try to promote exports and restrict imports, so that way more money would be coming into the economy, into the country, than would go out. And Smith showed in Wealth of Nations this isn't a very plausible view. So according to this idea, when Smith devoted his treatise, The Wealth of Nations, to attacking the mercantilists, he founded economics as a scientific discipline. And continuing with this older view, after Smith, there were a succession of other great figures. One was David Ricardo, the British economist who wrote the Principles of Political Economy, I think in 1870. Then John Stuart Mill, Principles of Political Economy, I think around 1848 or so. And then after him, now those were both British economists. Then we had the marginalist school, marginalists replaced the cost of production theory of value. And I'll go into a little bit later in the lecture what that is, that was held by Adam Smith, Ricardo, and Mill with a subjective theory of value. And here we had Karl Menger, who was Austrian, William Stanley Jevons, who's British, and Leon Walras, who was French and taught in Switzerland for a long time. Then after these marginalists were in the 1870s, then we had the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, Alfred Marshall, again, great British economist who summed up and extended economic knowledge into kind of a standard view of classical economics. And then after him was Lord Keynes, who showed in this standard view, of course this is not Rothbard's view, showed there were problems with the free market and there was a need for the government to act to order to end depressions. So you'll see one thing you can see right away, what's one thing that's very evident on this view. It starts off with Adam Smith, then goes to Ricardo, John Stuart Mill, the marginalist Alfred Marshall, or Keynes, is practically everybody on the list except for Menger and Walras is British. So this is a very British-centered view of economics. Now, a problem for this view is if you're going to say economics consists of a succession of great figures, then who is supposed to follow Keynes? There isn't any economist who's been generally accepted in this standard view to be Keynes's successor, sort of the great one who comes after him. Now, as I've said already, but saying something that never stops me from saying it again, one thing I like to say, I never repeat myself. No, I never repeat myself. Rothbard doesn't accept this view. He says it's a Whig interpretation of history. And this is a very, what does he mean when he says a Whig interpretation? Well, this expression comes from Herbert Butterfield, who was one of the great British historians of the 20th century. He taught at Cambridge University. He was a specialist in British history, particularly wrote about the reign of George III. He was also a great historian of science. He was a very wide-ranging historian. And an essay he wrote, I think came out around 1931, called The Whig Interpretation of History. He criticized a particular view that was, he found in the works of some historians associated with the Whig Party. Remember, this is was a party in England that was around in the 18th and 19th century. There's also an American Whig Party, but that's different. So the Whig historians who included such great figures as Thomas Macaulay and George Macaulay Trevelyan was another one, Whig historian. A lot of the Whig historians were in the same family. George Macaulay Trevelyan was related to Thomas Macaulay. So what these historians said, particularly when they're discussing how the British government had developed, they said there's been a constant progress toward more parliamentary government throughout British history. We'd started off with absolute monarchs, and then the powers of a monarch had been restricted, and the people had liberties had continually advanced. So in this view, things are always getting better and better until we reach the present. So what Butterfield objected wasn't that he thought it's a bad idea to have parliamentary sovereignty, maybe we should go back to absolute monarchy. That wasn't his criticism. He thought if you portray history that way, you're just judging events from the point of view of the present, and you're not considering the ideas as they appeared to the people at the time. If you looked at how the ideas appeared, the struggle, parliamentary struggle appeared to people at the time, it wasn't that they saw themselves as progressives versus reactionaries. They were reacting to rather to particular events that had happened in their own time. So what Butterfield was saying is you have to look at the ideas basically as they appeared to the actors at the particular time rather than looking, saying, what is progress, and then assigning marks to good guys and bad guys. Now, how would this Whig interpretation, remember things are always getting better and better, according to the Whig interpretation. Well, I see there's a question that Malcolm asks here. Is it a continuation of the type of thought that democracies don't go to war with each other or more peaceful? Yes, that could be. I mean, somebody could hold that view, democracies don't go to war with each other and more peaceful without taking a Whig view because the person could think there isn't an evolution toward democracy. But somebody could say, well, a Whig interpretation would be there's an evolution toward democracy worldwide, and this is a good thing because democracies don't go to war for each other. That is a common view. So you're quite right. That would be a continuation of the Whig interpretation if you took it that way. So how would we apply Whig interpretation to economics? Well, it would say that knowledge is continually increased. We know more today than Adam Smith did, and Ricardo knew more than Adam Smith, and Ricardo's successors knew more than he did, Keynes knew more than Alfred Marshall and so on, but we know more than our predecessors. We're constantly increasing knowledge. Many people have a picture of the physical sciences like that, say, we today know more than Newton did, for example. And why does Rothbard reject this? Why doesn't he accept this Whig account of history? Well, in his principal criticism is that that knowledge can be lost. He thinks that the basic knowledge of value theory in particular was lost after Adam Smith. Now, I'll be going into this in a little bit more detail later in the lecture, but basically, remember I mentioned already, Adam Smith had a cost of production theory of value. He said, if you want to know why, say, diamonds cost more than water, it's because it's harder to come up with diamonds, to produce diamonds. You have to dig them out of the ground, you have to mine them. It's much harder to produce diamonds, say, than to get water. Water is pretty easy to produce. You don't have to expend much labor in getting water. So that's why diamonds are more valuable than water. And Rothbard thinks that's not the right way to look at it at all. It's the right way to look at value is according to the subjective values people assign to goods. So you're not talking about cost of production, you're talking about what is the subjective value people give to goods. And Rothbard says it wasn't, say, that we start off with cost of production and then people later realize value theory is better. That did happen. Remember, the marginalists in the 1870s replaced the cost of production theories early. But that isn't the full story. And where this Whig interpretation wouldn't give the right answers is that, and of course, if you're doing the Whig interpretation, you just have the later value theory, the subjective theory, replace the earlier view with a better view. So you have cost of production is the wrong view, and then we now know that the marginalist, the subjective theory is better. But the difficulty comes in, according to Rothbard, is that people had the subjective view before Adam Smith. If Adam Smith took economic theory down the wrong road by bringing in this cost of production theory. So this isn't in accord with the Whig interpretation, because the Whig interpretation said everything keeps getting better and better, but here we have a view, we have the right view to begin with, then things got worse and then they got better after that, but there wasn't continuous progress because things got worse with Adam Smith. He got the wrong theory of value. And in his criticism of the Whig theory, Rothbard was very influenced by a famous book came out in 1962 by the Princeton historian of science, Thomas Kuhn, called The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. Has anybody read that book? It's a very well-known book. And what Kuhn did was he criticized this view of history of science as continuous progress. And Kuhn thought what you have to do, say, if you say compare, say, Copernican astronomy with the astronomy of Ptolemy, you'd say it wasn't that the new theory just came up with better answers than the old theory. He thought each theory asked different questions and had different concepts. So one, the new theory would replace an older theory, but it wouldn't be asking and answering exactly the same questions. So couldn't really talk about progress in a straightforward sense. You'd have different conceptual worlds. Rothbard doesn't fully accept that, but he was influenced by the book. So the, for example, Kuhn would say, you can't clearly say that Copernican astronomy is better than Ptolemaic astronomy by some sort of common standard. It's each of these theories is looking at the world in a different way. And it's just the new theory, in his famous word, paradigm, has replaced the old one. So that's a view that Rothbard was influenced by, the view, that view expressed in the book, but he didn't fully accept it. What he did accept from Kuhn and Butterfield was that you can't say in economics that there's been a continuous growth in knowledge. Now, Rothbard has, as I say, he doesn't accept this picture of economic theory or economic science as starting with Adam Smith. He has a counter narrative to this. So economics doesn't begin with Adam Smith. And as I've already suggested, if this were a mystery story, I would have ruined it by giving the plot in advance, is that Rothbard's account stresses the subjective nature of value as opposed to cost of production theory. So this is probably the key theme in Rothbard's History of Economics, that true economics is one that starts with a subjective nature of value, and then the bad economists are the ones he's opposed to, ones say value is determined by cost of production. And in Rothbard's account, he has discussions of economics in the Middle Ages also, but the Spanish scholastics of the 16th and early 17th century, who were centered at the University of Salamanca in Spain, are extremely important in Rothbard's account because they prefigured basic insights of Austrian economics. So what Rothbard is basically doing in his two volumes is he has what he considers, of course, the correct theory, Austrian economics, is developed by Mises and himself, and he's looking at history of economics and who came up with the basic concepts that were developed in Austrian economics. So in this way, even though he's against the Whig interpretation of a sense of continuous progress toward the present, his own view is one that I don't think Butterfield would have accepted, because Rothbard is definitely looking at which people in economics develop the correct views, as he considers to be the correct view. So it is very much a present-minded look at past economics. He's not saying, as some people did, well, economists of the past were in different, completely different conceptual worlds from those of the present, and they're really incommensurable, can't really be looked at in completely the same terms as present-day economists. He's not a supporter of that much extremer rejection of the Whig interpretation. He just said the Whig interpretation is wrong because we don't have continuous progress, but he's not rejecting a present-minded look at the past in the way, say, that Kuhn did in the Structural Scientific Revolutions. We have to ask, why were the Spanish scholastics so important? Since why was economics so developed in Spain during this period? Well, you remember, in the 16th century, Spain was the greatest European power. It was the strongest power in Europe. You know, in the famous Battle of the Spanish Armada in 1588, of course, the British won that battle, but what they did was that just prevented Spain from invading England. England at the time was a comparatively minor power, so all they did was, it's a great victory, but they just staved off invasion. And in the war that between Spain and England, of which the Spanish Armada 1588 was just one battle, that war didn't finally end until 1621, and in the Treaty of Peace, the Spaniards really had the upper hand. So Spain was the greatest power at the time, and the University of Salamanca was the world center for the study of economics at the time. The founder of the school was Francisco de Vitoria, who lived around 1485 to 1546. He's known, besides what he did in economics, he was a very strong defender of natural law, and he denounced the conquest and enslavement of the Indians in Spanish America. As you remember, Spain had colonies in Spanish America, and it wasn't a very good time for the Indians who were living there. In the Middle Ages, here we're getting into what were Vitoria's contributions to economic theory. Remember, we're going to be stressing subjective nature value. This is Rothbard's key theme. In the Middle Ages, there was a great deal of discussion on the so-called just price. What was the proper price according to justice? Now, some people, such as the British socialist historian Richard Henry Tawney, you took the view that the just price was something that could be used to criticize the market price. So Tawney thought that in the Middle Ages, people wrote on economics were saying we have to assess market price by certain criteria, and then it would turn out that very often market price isn't the right price, isn't the just price. But Rothbard, and I think he, in accord with most modern scholarship, said that isn't right. The view in the Middle Ages was that the just price was the prevailing market price. So if you say right now in Los Angeles, gasoline is selling, I think, about $3.85 a gallon. So if you said, is that the just price according to the Middle Ages view of things, it would depend, well, is that the prevailing market price? If it is, that's the just price. Whatever price prevails on the market is the just price. Now, Vitoria asked a very important question. He said, well, what if there isn't a prevailing market price? Not everything has a market price in the sense that there are a lot of buyers and sellers of that commodity. Say, suppose I said, well, what's the prevailing market price for my lectures? Well, there isn't much of a market for my lectures. I'm the only one who's selling them, and there aren't that many buyers either. So what if there isn't a prevailing market price? Vitoria then said, in that case, whatever the traders agreed on was the just price. Now, you might think, well, isn't that obvious if you think the prevailing market price is just or the right price, aren't you going to then say, well, if there isn't, aren't a lot of buyers and sellers, then wouldn't the price be whatever the people who are trading agreed on, even if there aren't very many of them? So I think that's obvious, but very often things that seem obvious are very often difficult to see. So once somebody's taken the step, they can see that's an obvious point, but until whoever it was, in this case Victoria, did take the next step, then people didn't see it. And even Victoria limited this principle that whatever the traders agree on is the just price to luxury goods. So he said, he didn't say if there is a prevailing market price, if there isn't a prevailing market price in a non-luxury good, then it's whatever the traders agreed on. I think his view was that maybe you'd have to have some sort of regulation on this. One of his students, who had the name, unusual name, Martin Gasbilqueta Navarez, went further. He lived 1493 to 1586, so he lived quite a long time, especially for someone living in those years. Even now, that's pretty good. So he went further than anyone before in his defense of the free market. And he made a very basic point. He opposed all government price fixing. He said, supposing a particular good, economic good, is abundant, there's a lot of it, everybody can, who wants to buy it and sell it can do so freely, then price controls don't have any effect. But if goods are scarce, then controls will cause harm. Supposing, say, there's a shortage of gasoline, then if a government says, well, we don't want these horrible exploiters to just jack up the price of gasoline, so we'll impose some price controls, then there are a lot more people will be demanding the gasoline available for supply at that price, so the control won't work, it'll just make things more difficult. Again, this is a point you get in any elementary economics course, how price controls don't work, but at the time he made it, as Gasbilqueta made it, it was an important insight. So again, to reiterate, when Rothbard is looking at the history of economics, what he's interested in, his fundamental criterion for evaluating an economist, is how close did the economist come to Austrian insights. And one economist that he likes very much, named Richard Cantillon, who lived from the early 1680s to 1734, was an economist who comes out very highly according to this way of looking at things that Rothbard is saying again, who comes closest to Austrian insights. Cantillon had a very interesting life. He was an Irishman who moved to France, and he was involved in the famous Mississippi bubble of John Law. He invested in that. That was a credit bubble that was involved in investment in an overseas company that was supposed to develop the French colonies in America. And it had a very, it created credit boom and then collapse in the French economy. And he died under rather odd circumstances. I think there was a fire in his house, and he was either murdered or, according to some accounts, he escaped. He was a very colorful character and sometimes wasn't too careful to obey the law if he could make some money by violating it. But that isn't why Rothbard liked him. Cantillon's most important contribution was in the theory of money. So let's suppose that new money is introduced into the economy. we could have, we could imagine, say, there's, if you had a gold standard, there are some miners who mine new gold and they bring the gold into the economy. Say you have, for example, Spain had gotten gold from Peru and then brought it into Spain. Or you could imagine, say, a case where the government just prints up money and gives it to certain people. So what's going to happen? Well, those who get the money first will spend it on products they want. Supposing somebody gets some new money, he's going to say, well, what do I want to buy with this? He'll spend it on products they want. Then people who get that money will then spend it on products they want. So the new money will gradually circulate through the economy, because people who get the money first are spending it on what they want. Then the people who get the money that they spend it on will spend it on other things. So the money is going to circulate. Now, as the money spreads through the economy, the prices of goods that are demanded more will rise. People have new money, so they're increasing their spending on certain goods, and then this will make prices rise. So what happens when this process occurs? Well, people who haven't gotten any of the new money yet will find it's harder to buy goods. Remember, people with the new money are able to buy goods, so there won't be as many available to people who don't have the new money yet. And there's thus a shift of goods to those with the new money. They have extra money, so that puts them in a better position to buy things than those who haven't gotten the money yet, because the new money hasn't circulated to them yet. So these effects, incidentally, since they were discovered by Richard Cantia, this effect of these differential effects of money, new money on the economy, are called Cantillon effects. That seems a pretty reasonable to call them. I mean, you're not going to call them Adam Smith effects if Cantillon was the one who wrote about them. Another economist, this 18th century French economist, who was one of Rothbard's favorites, is Turgot, who lived from 1727 to 1781. Turgot came from a family of royal officials and was important. He was an important royal official himself. Rothbard considers Turgot worthy of a brilliancy prize. Where did he get the concept of brilliancy prize from? Remember, Rothbard was very interested in chess. He followed the chess columns in chess tournaments. Very often have in a tournament, not only you have a prize for the winner of the tournament, but there is a prize for the player who plays the most brilliant game, as assessed by whoever is judging the tournament. And Rothbard thinks that Turgot was really brilliant because he wrote less than 200 pages, but he arrived at many insights. And Turgot's policies, he was generally a supporter of laissez-faire, that is, he didn't want the government to intervene in the economy, but he believed that the way to advance this was to try to convince laissez-faire, to try to convince the king to adopt his policies. So he was a supporter, at least for the time, of monarchy, because he thought if we get a good king who can be convinced to advance free market, then this would be a good way to get to the free market, just have a king put in the correct programs. What happened? Turgot was a very strong supporter of free trade, both domestically and between nations. Now, when people talk about free trade today, they said, you think of trade between foreign countries, say if you favored free trade between the U.S. and China, you would be meaning there shouldn't be tariffs between the U.S. and China. But we don't think of free, so much of free trade within a particular country, like we don't talk about free trade between California and New York, because we take it for granted today that within a nation there wouldn't be any tariffs. But this wasn't always the case, and in France in the 18th century there were internal tariffs. There were, if you wanted to ship goods from one part of France to another, you would very often have to pay a tariff to do so. So it was, there would be internal, you could be in favor of internal free trade as well as external free trade. In supporting free trade, again, Turgot made an argument that today seems obvious to us, but it was an important insight, is that he said trade takes place only if both parties expect to benefit from it. So in one of his arguments for free trade, he said, well, look, if people in different countries or different parts of the same country in different parts of France want to trade, they will do so only if they both think they're going to be better off. So if you block trade, then you're preventing people from being better off according to their own lights. Now, what if you countered that by saying, well, even if people think they're going to be better off, maybe they're making a mistake about it, maybe the government knows better than the individuals on the scene what's good for everybody. And Turgot's answer to this was, the free market uses local knowledge that people have. And a centrally controlled system couldn't do that. A centrally controlled system couldn't amass all the local knowledge that people have on how things should be produced or what people want. Some of it can't be put into, it's just known by the people on the scene. They can't really write it down in some form that could be transmitted. So really it's only the free market that can use the local knowledge that people have. And this is a basic idea that in 20th century Friedrich Hayek developed, that the free market uses local knowledge. But Turgot pioneered this in the 18th century. Now we get, I've given you some that economists Turgot, the Spanish scholastics, Cantillon Turgot, that Rothbard liked. But now we get into the good part, which is people we didn't like so much. It's always fun watching Rothbard when he's attacking somebody. So now what we stressed is that Rothbard rejects the view that Adam Smith founded economics. He also rejects the view that economics has been a continually progressive science since Smith's book, The Wealth of Nations, appeared in 1776. But he goes further than that. It's not just that Smith is not the founder of economics. He thinks that Smith's main doctrines are all wrong, and he was an obstacle to progress. So he really has a very, very negative view of Adam Smith. One view that Smith held that Rothbard thought had some bad influence on subsequent economics was that only labor that produces material objects counts as productive. So a service, in Smith's view, is consumed when it's taking place. But if you produce a material object, it's there afterwards. So, say, when I'm giving a lecture, I'm not doing anything productive because I'm just talking. But the people who record what I say are doing productive work because they've got some kind of an object, say a tape or whatever it is they have, that's there afterwards. It's, again, it's only physical objects, working on physical objects, that counts as productive. And according to Rothbard, this stress on productive labor reflects a Calvinist influence that hard work producing things is really important. One of the themes, I'm not going to go into it in this lecture, that Rothbard stresses, is the influence of religion on economics. And he thinks Smith was influenced by the Calvinist tradition. Now I see Malcolm asked a good question, how does Marx account for service? Well, remember, this view isn't that there aren't such things as services, but just that these services don't count as productive. So he just say they're activities that take place in addition to production, but there's no special problem of why there are services. They're just paid for out of what he considers productive labor, and the same Smith would also hold that view. Smith, as I said, had a cost of production theory of value, and this is opposed to the view that Rothbard thinks is the correct view, namely that prices are determined by the values people assign to the goods that are traded by their utility. Now, why did Smith reject that view? Why, suppose you're saying, why, say, do is baseball players, certain baseball players in major leagues earn so much money? Well, it's not because they're spending a lot of labor in learning how to be, say, great hitters or fielders. It's that people want to see them play, and they're willing to pay a lot of money to watch them. So you might think, well, isn't it obvious that utility determines prices? But Smith had an objection. He said goods that have a high value in exchange often have a low value in use. For example, this is a similar, exactly the same as what they call the diamond water paradox. He said that water is vital for life, so it has a very high use value, but you won't get very much money for it. But diamonds don't have that much subjective value to people in use, but it has a very high exchange value. So it can't be that utility determines price because diamonds have lower utility than water, but a higher price. Now, what's wrong with this? Well, of course, you're not in exchanging all of the diamonds in the world against all the water. You're just exchanging a particular quantity of them. So even if it's true that without water as a whole is more valuable to human beings than diamonds, in the sense that if there were no water at all, everybody would die, but people could get along without any diamonds. It's still the case that particular units of water can be worth less than particular units of diamonds because there's so much water available that individual units aren't worth that much. Now, the odd thing about Smith's use of this argument was that Smith in his lectures had solved the diamond water paradox in earlier lectures. He ignored his own discussion in his book. Now, of course, this raises the question, why do that if he had the solution himself? Well, one answer is that he was concerned with what he called long run or natural prices, not with day-to-day prices. So he's saying, well, people's utilities or valuations of goods would change a lot. So what he wants to come up with is long-lasting regularities of prices. And here, what Rother would take to be wrong with that is that equilibrium or these long-run prices, it's certainly a valid concept, but it's never actually reached because the data are constantly changing. But in Smith's view, because utility can't determine these equilibrium or long-run prices, you have to look at something else, and that's the cost of production. Now, in order to understand Rothbard's approach to history of economics, his discussion of David Ricardo in the second volume of his book is crucial. In the standard view that Rothbard challenges, Ricardo's Principles of Political Economy and Taxation, which came out in 1817, is the next great book in economics after The Wealth of Nations in 1776. And what the standard view is that Ricardo was really the one who established economics as a rigorous science. So Smith was really was the one who, according to the standard view that Rothbard's attacking, Smith really first invented economics as a separate science, but it was Ricardo developed economics into a rigorous science. And David Friedman, who's an extremely bright libertarian theorist and economist, takes this view. He regards Ricardo's book as one of the all-time great books in economics. But Rothbard doesn't accept this. And he takes this to be part of this Whig interpretation where economics is theories always getting better and better. According to Rothbard, Ricardo made disastrous mistakes, and Ricardian economics is almost all wrong. And in one respect, according to Rothbard, Ricardo was even worse than Adam Smith, because Smith was concerned with how economies grow. Remember, he's talking, his book is The Wealth of Nations. I think the full title is An Inquiry into the Nature and Causes of the Wealth of Nations. So Smith is concerned with how economies grow. But Ricardo had a different question. He wanted to know how income is distributed, assuming the economy is static. So what's wrong with that? Well, according to Austrian economics, there aren't separate laws of distribution. Once all the individuals in the economy make their production and consumption decision, there isn't a remaining question about distribution. So you don't have production takes place first, then we have a separate question. How is income to be distributed, say, among landlords, laborers, and capitalists? But as the individuals make their production consumption decisions, that answers all the questions. So this assumption by Ricardo, there are separate laws of distribution, leads to another mistake. He wasn't concerned with individual prices or aggregates. So what he would ask, say, would be, what determines wages, meaning all the payments of labor in the economy. So he isn't asking what determines an individual wage, he's saying what determines aggregate wages. And this, in Rothbard's view, is not the way to do it. Now, so Ricardo is another one of the bad guys. Now we get, and this will be the last person I'll talk about, is John Stuart Mill, who was Ricardo's successor in the School of British Classical Economics. And one of the things I like very much about a very amusing feature of the volume two of Rothbard's book is he has a very low opinion of Mill personally, just doesn't like the guy, and he's very open in expressing that view. And what he doesn't like about him, he regards him as a kind of a woolly thinker who had trouble making up his mind. And what he says is that instead of coming down on, Danny points out in a lecture that he called Mill El Wimpo. Yes, that wasn't a compliment. So he said instead of coming down on one side or other of an issue, he would try to incorporate both sides. Now you see, those incidentally are two separate complaints. One is he doesn't take a stand on particular issues. You know, it's like the story I may have given you this one before of a judge who was listening to a case, and after the prosecutor had finished his case, the judge said, "You're right, I agree with you completely." And then at that point, the defense attorney jumped up and said, "Your Honor, you agreed with the prosecutor after he presented his case, but that isn't fair. You ought to listen to what I say before you make your decision." And the judge said, "You're perfectly right, I agree with you." Then at this point, the court bailiff couldn't stand it anymore. He said, "Your Honor, you've agreed with both the prosecutor and defense, but they're giving contradictory views. You can't agree with both of them." And the judge said, "Well, you're right, too." So Rothbard thought Mill was like that, and since he wouldn't commit himself to one point of view and the other, he would just try to include both conflicting views within his own position in a way that wasn't reconciling. So see, those are separate complaints, because you could have somebody who incorporates conflicting views in his own position but still comes down on one side or the other, or you could have people who just don't decide between things but don't claim to have some more comprehensive view incorporating both. But Mill did both of these things. I want to conclude with a great quotation from Rothbard on John Stuart Mill. He said, "John Stuart was the quintessence." Why did he just call him John Stuart? Because remember, the father, whom he liked much better, was named James Mill. But he said, "John Stuart was the quintessence of soft rather than hardcore, a woolly-minded man of mush in striking contrast to his steel-edged father. John Stuart Mill was the sort of man who, hearing or reading some view seemingly at utter variance with its own, would say, 'Yes, there is something in that,' and proceed to incorporate this new inconsistent strand into his capacious and muddled worldview. Hence, Mill's ever-expanding intellectual synthesis was rather a vast kitchen midden of diverse and contradictory positions." And I don't think I could come up with anything remotely equaling that, so I'll stop the lecture now and we can go into the questions, discussions, and objections as you like. Well, now here's one from Malcolm. "So how does MR differ from Kuhn? Is it that MR doesn't believe it just has to be different paradigms, it can be incorrect paradigms?" Well, I think that would be one way of getting at it, that what Rothbard is really rejecting is the view that if you look, say, at economists in the 18th century, say, compared with the 20th century, one view would be the older economists had just completely different concepts from the ones we do have now. So they're asking and answering different questions, and you can't really assess them by saying, "We're answering the same questions that those in the 18th century. We're just coming up with better answers." It's just that they have different, altogether different concepts, and there's no there isn't much common ground on which you can assess one theory against another. Rothbard didn't accept that view. He thought there definitely was a correct view and an incorrect view. So that, I think you're right. Now, that is why he's rejecting Kuhne. You have a good way of putting it. He thought there can be incorrect paradigms. Now, even so, just out of curiosity, how do you think Rothbard would have handled noisy neighbors, assuming they refused to quiet down and can't force them to be quiet or have the material? Well, I don't know what he would probably just complained about it to people. I don't think he would have had any special way of dealing with it. He wasn't the sort who would take direct action and try to shut them up on his own. He would, you know, he was a very ordinary, peace-loving person. He never, you know, he wouldn't do anything unusual. Now, Malcolm says he would write a movie review. Well, he very well might. He was very good at attacking those who he didn't like. Now, Malcolm says, to what extent does Scholastic Salamanca affect Spanish government policy toward laissez-faire? Well, I don't think they had perhaps some effect. They didn't have a complete effect in that way. I mean, sometimes there were a few who, I think there was one, Countess Mariana, who was locked up for a while because he protested the government's economic policies. I mean, the people would read what they said, and they had some influence, but they weren't controlling the thought of the Spanish government at the time. Spanish government at the time was very definitely not a laissez-faire government. But remember, though, at that time in early modern Europe, we're talking about Europe in the 16th, 17th century, although the state didn't recognize, say, the same liberties we do, and there were all sorts of regulations, the state really had much less power in the sense they couldn't get their laws enforced all that easily. It was people could just ignore what the government was doing ordered in very many cases. So even though you have what sounds something like very authoritarian regimes, then the government wasn't always able to get the central policy as it wanted. So people would just ignore it, and then. Now, here's one from Craig. M.R. had disagreements with Mises, yet regarded both of them as Austrians. R. was known to accuse George Riesman of becoming a Ricardian. Do you know whether he ever softened much in his views about Riesman? Well, I think his view was that Riesman had tried to combine Austrian economics with certain elements of Ricardian economics. I think that was always his view. So I don't think he changed what he said. Wait, now this is skipping a bit. Wait, let me just go back up to the top here. Now, Malcolm says, did M.R. think the Pareto principle had any uses? If so, where do you see it applying? Well, you remember, I think I talked a little bit about this in one of the lectures. In his article, 1956, Toward a Reconstruction of Utility and Welfare Economics, he mentioned the Pareto principle, that's a chain, you should put in a chain that makes at least one person better off and no one worse off. But he said if you combine that with demonstrated preference, you're just concerned with preferences that are actually capable of being seen in action, not just thoughts that people have in their mind, then you could only apply it to say if there's a market transaction on the free market, then it passes the Pareto test. Otherwise, if there's government intervention, it doesn't. So he used it as a way of supporting the free market, kind of routing the welfare economists who had criticisms of the free market. Danny suggests that his easement theory was similar to Hoppe, so he'd probably agree with Hoppe regarding noisy neighboring. I've forgotten, what does Hans say about noisy neighbors?
I quote him below.
I'll have a look at that. Thank you. Now, Leslie said, did Turgot associate with Diderot and Voltaire? I'm sure he was aware of them. I don't know if they had any close association, but I have to look into that. Now, Voltaire was not a supporter of laissez-faire at all. I mean, he was, although he had some interesting criticisms of the physiocrats, but Voltaire was, I think, not someone who would have been such a great free market supporter. Well, now here's one from quoting Hans. If A currently physically damaged property, B, for example, depending on whose property right was established earlier, if A's property was found first, he was performing the question like this, then A may continue. I see, so he's saying Hans is taking in terms of who was the noise going on when the person who's complaining about it acquired the property. That actually is a view that's sometimes taken in conventional law also. Now, Danny also pointed out Turgot contributed to Diderot's encyclopedia. You know, almost everybody important in France, the intellectual important, contributed to the encyclopedia. It was a very big deal at the time. Oh, here's one. Mal says, you mentioned what MR thought was what certain economists got wrong. Always say they got correct. Is there a book where MR writes about what his previous economists got correct and wrong? Because you do this volume on history of economics. Robert asked, did Rothbard leave any notes for volume 3? Well, yes, this is what he's doing in the two volumes of the history of economics. He's indicating what the correct and incorrect views were that various economists had. On volume 3, there's some conflicting stories about that. Apparently, Rothbard had some things that he'd written for it, or had, according to some accounts, he made recordings or had certain notes on it. But the status of that is uncertain. We do know, I think, there are certain things he would have included in it. You know, you can get online some of his lectures that deal with economists who lived after the period of volume 2. Malcolm says, I'm reading Frank Chodorow, Income Tax, Root of All Evil. What did MR think of Chodorow personally in economics? Well, he thought very highly of Chodorow. Chodorow was one of his persons who was early mentors in the libertarian movement. And I think he thought extremely highly of him. I remember that income tax book, Root of All Evil, myself. It's a very good book. I read that in 1962. It's a very good book. I think where he differed with Chodorov, Chodorov was a Georgist, although in his later life he didn't stress that. Chodorov thought that really land is owned by the community, and Rothbard didn't accept that. Now, Craig says, after reading the history, go for Manikine statement stuff about the Fed and take credit for having read volume 3. Well, I mean, I agree with the first two parts of your sentence. I don't know whether your conclusion would follow, but I certainly agree with your first two parts. Now, Kevin says, have you or other Austrians read much of Taleb, the Black Swan guy? Are your opinions about his writing circulated? Well, I've read a little bit of him. I think there are many Austrians who like him because he takes a view, he's very pro-Hayek, and he takes a view of probability that's similar to, in some respects, to that of Mises. So I think he's pretty well regarded in Austrian circles. Yes, and Kevin said he also loves Popper. Yes, he likes John Gray also, who's not in such good standing in at the Mises Institute. I remember John Gray's a British political philosopher who taught at Oxford and London School of Economics. I remember he was known at least at one time for changing his political views every 6 months or so. And Murray used to say about him, well, there are two views he thought Gray would never adopt, communism and the free market laissez-faire policy, but he might be anything between those. Now here's one from Malcolm. In contrasting Chodorov's views on community, did MR believe a community could not choose to own property, trust, or some form of community ownership with a way for an individual to see? No, that wasn't the view he was rejecting. The view that he's rejecting is there can't be individual ownership of property originally. We start off with all property owned by a community. That wouldn't, his Rothbard's view wouldn't exclude a community, a group of people from just acquiring homesteading property as a group, but the Georgist view is that you don't acquire property by homesteading, it's just all the people in the community own the property. And so the individuals who acquire property really owe all the rent on the property to the community. Danny says Rothbard wrote a lovely obituary for Chodorov in the journal Left and Right. Yes. Yes, and now Leslie says, does Rothbard see any connection between British imperialism and the Smith-Ricardo Mill line of economic thought? Both the fact of decline of liberalism, the relation between the two. Well, here we have a bit of a difference. Adam Smith, remember, was an opponent of colonies. He thought that that wasn't very good for the economy. And Ricardo, I don't think, wrote much on this issue, but John Stuart Mill was someone who supported the British Empire. Remember, his main occupation was he was a very high official of British East India Company. He defended colonialization. So I think there'd be some connection there between John Stuart Mill and British imperialism. Malcolm said, would that inherently mean that all Georgians are statists? No, you could have, Chodorov was an anarchist Georgist, Albert J. Nock also, they would just hold the community owns the property, but that wouldn't follow. They have to have a state that owns it. Did Rothbard express any opinions on the popular books written by Robert J. Ringer? He didn't, I don't recall he said too much. I don't think he thought very much of Ringer, but I don't recall that as being one of something that he, I think his view, as I recall, was that sort of Ringer was not a serious thinker, somebody was just out for himself, but he was kind of a bit of a poseur, but he didn't really say too much about him. Now Rob says, how did George define his community? How big was it? Well, he didn't really specify in Progress and Poverty. He seemed to be talking about nations as they existed when he was writing in the 19th century, but he really didn't say too much about that issue. Now, Leslie wants to know, did you ever play Rothbard in chess? No, I'm not a chess player. I learned the game when I was very young, but I never really took it up. I'm sure I would do very badly. Now, Bob Wendell said, did Rothbard say much about contemporaries such as Herbert Stein or Thomas Sowell? Well, he did. I don't recall him saying anything about Stein. He thought about Thomas Sowell. I think he thought he'd made some mistakes. He thought, especially his interpretation of Marxism, he thought was too pro-Marxist. See, Sowell started off as a Marxist, and in a book he did on Marx, he really incorporated his senior thesis, which was pretty sympathetic to Marx, with some later stuff. And one view he didn't like that Sowell had was that Sowell thought Bombavik's criticism of Marx was wrong, and Rothbard didn't like that view at all. So Craig says Ringer's niche was using Randian ideas in a self-help book, which he didn't. He seems more explicitly anarchist. Now, I didn't know if he's still around. I didn't know that. I thought maybe they'd put in a Ringer for him instead. Oh, good. Rob thought that was funny. Well, it was the best I could do on short notice. You know, considering that I told you I had eye problems earlier this week, so I couldn't give the lecture regular time, maybe I should have given my argument on Kant and the transcendental ego, also known as the transcendental I. See, in these lectures, I have to confine myself to academic jokes. I can't give you too much of the really good stuff. Oh, no, my favorite joke was actually a comment that Ralph Rako made, but I'd better not give that. Now, Malcolm, if you were prioritize what needs to be done to get to limited no government, what would you rate as top five in what order? Repeal 1617 Amendment, repeal Fed, repeal eminent domain. I'd have to think about that. I think ending the Fed would be very good. Leslie thinks secession. Yes, as Clyde Wilson says, if at first you don't secede, try again. Rob says, Tom Woods has warned us about your joke. Now, Bob Wendell says, how about Lindzel says, how about a Rothbard joke or comment? Let me see what would be something he gave as a joke once. Wait, I have to think. Most of his, a lot of his jokes, let me see what would be something good that he, I could just think of that I can tell. Oh, here's Kevin has, woman walked into a bartender to do a long time, so he gave it to her. Oh, that, Danny says, when a lecture attendee told Robert he was not being unfair, his whole regarding the Marx book, Robert began his response, I think I'm not being unfair enough. Well, I remember one time, there was a story, Leland Yeager was listening to a lecture by Rothbard, and he asked Rothbard, he said, could you explain how the Austrian theory of the business cycle differs from some other theory that Yeager was interested in? And Rothbard said, no, I won't. Or another one, there was a woman who attended one of the early Mises University, and an older woman, I think she must have been in her 70s, who asked in one of the question periods, was Mises an atheist? And Rothbard said, you asked me that last night. Now, I remember one Ralph Rayfair, he likes to say things like, what's wrong with you? I'm not as funny, I'm not as stupid as you look. One time, I remember I saw Ralph was wearing a white suit. So I said to him, you look like an ice cream salesman. And Ralph said, yeah, I'd hate to tell you what you look like. Oh, Craig thanks everybody for sharing jokes, including me. Well, thank you, Craig. That's very generous. You'll pass the course. I'll give you the one I heard from Jan Narveson. An economist is someone who doesn't have the personality to be an accountant. Now, Malcolm says, what do you think of the most exciting things going on with regard to the fight for liberty, organizations, et cetera, besides Mises? I don't know. I think the Mises Institute, it keeps me pretty busy. I'm sure there are other good groups. Now, Craig says, well, it passed, of course, then you earn your Stefan Molyneux who died for my sins t-shirt. I'd rather have that he died, Stefan Molyneux who died for his sins. Danny says, Bob Shaw asks, what did Rothbard think of Walter Williams? Well, I don't recall him saying anything particular about Walter Williams. I'm sure he thought Williams did some good stuff. I remember Walter Williams when he was a grad student at UCLA. I remember he attended a lecture given by James Buchanan in 1969, and he asked a question. Well, all right, I guess we've run out of time, so we'll see you all next week. I remember next week the lecture will be at the usual time, which is Tuesday at 5:30 Eastern Time. So I hope we'll see you all then. Thanks very much, and again, I'm sorry I couldn't give the lecture at the usual time this week. Thanks very much, everybody.